service animal that was not a, you know, it needed to be kept in a container, and actually all these little pug dogs and things that you see are supposedly well-trained service animals.
Yeah.
I'll believe it when I see one of them do something that's worth a good god.
You mean...
I mean those little mutts, those pooches, are worthless layabouts and lie-arounds. Soldiers, they simply have nothing to do except to eat expensive designer dog food. Reveal that Ted talks to nodding hipsters.
Mm. But what about the battle dogs?
Oh, well, that's different. Bob, son of battle, you get some of those big German shepherds and others. You don't want to stand in their way. And I think I told you about how once a dog allowed me to get on an airplane because that dog outranked everybody in the police department and the security in the airport. And that dog said I was good to go. And it's good that he did, because I, of course, had drugs on me back in those pre-9/11 days.
Right.
It was very close to then. I was in a Newark airport, and they didn't like the look of my luggage, and I offered to open it, but they shuddered in horror at the prospect that I would do that. And meanwhile, everybody behind me knew that things were held up and that it was all my fault, even though I wasn't trying to do anything. I didn't want to be searched, obviously. Anyway, this cop in shorts on a bicycle came riding through the airport, and next to him was trotting this enormous German shepherd with a vest on, you know, which is a special bomb-detecting dog. The dog came up to my bag, it took one sniff, then it took its enormous dishpan-sized paw and slapped the side of the briefcase, and everybody relaxed and said, okay, now they let me go through.
You didn't try to bribe the doggy with treats or anything?
No, I didn't try to draw any more attention to myself. I did do an injudicious thing by saying, you don't want to give me an apology for doing this. They said, oh, no, this is a security matter. Something may be going on. We're trying to stop it.
And this is pre-9/11.
Yes.
Yeah.
In New Jersey, in Newark, that airport there that they have there.
It's hard to even imagine. I mean, I can't remember anyway. That's what I meant to say. I can't remember the time, because I remember airports being kind of, you know, full of drudgery and everything, but it's like they didn't become these like military zones until...
Well, how about taking off your shoes and all that stuff?
Yeah, yeah, all that, you know, just TSAs and, you know, just the whole construct of security that came after the fact, you know. I mean, when I was a little kid, like, getting on an airplane was like getting on a bus or something.
Yeah, and everybody could go to the gate and say goodbye to you. You know, people who didn't have tickets, they could easily go.
Yeah. They didn't have those...
helicopters?
You know, well, those tubes that you had to walk through to get onto the plane. Sometimes you could just
walk
on the tarmac and
walk up the ladder. Well, I've taken some flights recently where you walk down the ladder from the plane. And I ain't so good at walking down those ladders no more.
No, you mean...
Though I'm not a...
Ladders or steps?
They're steps, but, yeah. I mean, they wheel them up, you know. It's Donald Trump has trouble with them, too.
Well, we could all laugh at his TikTok videos. Look at him. He doesn't know how to negotiate shares.
Pill party to pill party.
What a maroon.
Yeah.
Of course, doesn't every president have a fumbling upstairs video?
A lot of them do recently. Of course, they didn't always video it. And back in the day, if the president did something like that, they wouldn't show it.
Right.
They want to make everything look good because they know other countries, huge audiences would be watching. And
right.
So I wanted to entertain those folks, too, with the right idea about our country.
Yeah.
Not run by stumblebums weaving and darting in an alcoholic fog, spasmodically gesticulating and juddering on the stairway.
I guess we can't say anything, really, because of all the guns, you know, the country has.
Yes, everybody is armed to the teeth.
Levi's. That's Grace Slick, yeah?
Yes, singing about white Levi's. I always thought that only jerks wore those white Levi's.
Well, I always thought jerks drove Camaros.
Yes.
And then I rented one.
Oh.
And I had such a good time driving it. It was like, I guess I'm one of those jerks. Oh, yeah, kind of thing. I'm driving, and it was a white Camaro to boot, you know.
Yeah, well.
White Levi's, white Camaro.
Right. A convertible, huh?
No, it wasn't a convertible.
Ah, well, of course, the ultimate top. Obnoxious coolness.
But I was in a
convertible.
I was in a Camaro, like a 1998 or 1990, as a rental car, and I kept it for like 2 weeks, and I drove up to Arcata with it, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
If you're 14, you're too young. If you're 18.
That was around the time that I got a second organ. Like, I had a Hammond B1 for a while, and then I got this other console organ. And when I went up to the store in Arcata, where it was like a thrift store, that was my reconnaissance of it. I was like, yeah, I'm going to buy this. And then later I got a U-Haul, and then I U-Hauled it back to Santa Rosa.
You still own it? Do you still have it?
I do not. No.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It is, it got torn to pieces like C-3PO in Empire Strikes Back.
By whom?
By me, because it became defective, and then I just chopped it out for parts, you know.
Could use the parts, eh?
Well, I mean, I could just have them as, you know, as ornaments, you know, like little control switches and, you know, the black keys and the white keys.
Yes.
You know, little things to keep.
I need to get one to get some kind of keyboard so I can practice playing. The problem is where to get it, and where to put it, I mean. And I was thinking maybe get the ones that roll up, you know, you can unroll them and play on them and then roll them back.
I almost wanted to bring, like, a keyboard to the show tonight just because my introduction to Grux was made at a Carolina show that he played at he played the cafe in 94. And in 1994, he played, and at the end of the show, I was buzzing. I was really kind of on fire, right? It was like such a great show. So I went to the Hammond B1 organ, and I started kind of doing like a 96 tiers, kind of a chop, you know, and Grux loved it, and then he booked me to do an organ show a couple years later at the Commotion. And it was called Organ Spectacular, and I never played as a live musician before, but you know, Grux wanted me to play it, and I did, and I said, I don't have a name, like, what do you put on the flyer? You know, do you just put Rob, you know, or Rob Cole or whatever? And it's like, that's boring, and it's just like, so he said, how about the Crob?
I see.
And this is in 1997. So he said the crob, T-H-E-K-R-O-B, and I heard that as a kind of a like a crab almost, you know, like the crab, you know. So I thought like maybe I'll get like crab hands and play the keyboard organ, you know.
That would make it a little simpler.
With crab hands, right?
Yes.
And so I didn't invest in the theatrical prop or character design.
So this is the secret origins of K-Rob?
This is the origin of K-Rob.
Yeah.
It started out as the crab because Grux heard me playing organ after his show that I booked in 1994 where Carolina played. He booked the organ spectacular, came up with the name, the crab, and then when I started doing pirate radio, a la SF Liberation Radio, and doing Ask Dr. Hal and Chicken John shows and stuff, I went with the K-Rob variant because it sounded like radio.
Yes, well, there is a link to radio.
Yeah. But that's kind of how I just took the basic name and then just rerouted it a little bit. Like, oh, I'm going to put a different twang on it or whatever, you know, to make it more me and not just like some... Because the crab sounded like a kind of a creature, you know. Like, I didn't figure, like, oh, I could be a human and do stuff, you know.
Right. Beware the crab. Harry Hoyt. But after all, you did have the K-R-O-B thing sung.
Bessie Love and Wallace.
Oh, yeah. Yasha and...
John Roxton.
Wasn't it Ariella Morgenstern?
Ariella Morgenstern did the chorus-y work on it, yeah.
I didn't realize Yasha was in there.
I think it was Yasha's idea. It was Chicken's idea. Like, it was, he wanted a logo.
I thought it was my idea.
Oh, really?
I worked hard to get it to happen.
Oh, my God. I had no idea. Yeah, I thought it was like Chicken wanted it because of the Ask Dr. Hal show. He wanted like a stage, like a fanfare thing. And so it's like singing like a radio. But that was you. You're the one that told... Both of them, or Yasha, or both, or what?
I had no idea Yasha was involved. I only wanted it to happen.
Right.
And I think Chicken helped get the recording session set up. But,
I get you.
You know, I wasn't there when it happened, but I really liked the sound of it.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, it'd be great to...
What, to make some more of those?
Yeah, to make, like, you know, like when PAMs and all those, like, vocal identification people would do stuff, it's like, take 10, and they would have all these, you know, they had all these different variants, like, K101 weather, you know. They would just do a bunch of them because you'd buy packages, you know, you'd buy all those identification packages came with, you know, like band intro, vocals only, you know, all that kind of stuff. TM Productions.
So you had a beer, you said.
Yeah. PAMS was, I think, like specifically vocals, though. The PAMS jingles.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think, like, those are the ones that were, like, they played to their strength, and their strength was in the a cappella delivery of the call letters and stuff.
Well, it takes precise singers like the Andrews Sisters or somebody like that.
Yeah. No, it's cool. Lots of friends I haven't seen tonight.
That is cool.
Just kind of popping up, and I rarely get into social situations where I see like more than one old friend or more than one new friend. Or
and they're there just for the show, or you're just happening to run into them?
Well, I mean, they're there for the show, obviously, yeah. You know, the show is the magnet. If anyone knows what magnets are.
Well, Donald Trump doesn't seem to. You know, heard his speech about how if you drop a water on a magnet, it ruins it and so on.
But didn't he say recently that no one knows what they are?
What magnets are, yes. Yeah. Except maybe him.
Yeah. Only I can think it.
And some kid swallowed a bunch of magnets and had to be operated on because naturally they all fastened together and made a bad shaped thing in his insides.
Oh, right, right.
You might pass one magnet, but not a whole bunch of them all attached together.
Right. I usually pass on magnets.
Yes, let us pause and think of the wonder and the beauty of magnetism. Truly, it was said by a great American, Chester Gould, that he who controls magnetism controls the universe. And that's how Dick Tracy flew around in his levitating platform in the space age, Dick Tracy. Do you ever read that comic?
Which one?
Dick Tracy.
The comic? Well, I never actually read it.
Yeah. Oh, it used to be in the paper all the time. It seemed immortal, eternal. It would never go away. It was always there, and then it went away. But
I mean, I remember seeing it in the lineup, but I never really paid attention to it.
Well, he's very hardcore right-wing and also weird and so...
Square-jawed.
I meant Chester Gould, the cartoonist. But yes, the square-jawed Dick Tracy was parodied by Al Capp as Fearless Fodzik, and his somewhat repulsive girlfriend was Prudence Pimpleton, but Dick Tracy's actual girlfriend is kind of hard to take. Then there was Junior, the very strange-looking kid who's always getting into trouble. But in later years, just before it stopped, they went to the moon. They discovered a moon civilization, and then there was the moon maid who has these little dealy bob antennas, you know, who was in the stories. And sometimes he would go off on a strange track, like Tess is cooking dinner on her stove, which is also a TV. It's a stove, and yet it's a TV. Look, there's a screen there. She's cooking on the stove, but she's watching TV. You know, a very strange way for the comic to divert when it was usually about hard-fisted, straight-thinking Dick Tracy versus a number of bizarre villains that could give Batman's villains a run for the money,
right.
Like Flat Top and BB Eyes, Prune Face, or one that intrigues me, Little Face. You know, he's like a normal guy, except his face is actually this small area on the front of his head.
Who did Al Pacino play in the movie?
Yeah, he played one of them. He played one of the chief villains. I'm drawing a blank on his name, though. And he was slightly less grotesque than the other ones, but he was still pretty grotesque.
Yeah.
Well, they're talking about magnets, but they don't know who Al Pacino played. But he's the one who won't let Madonna get through a song, you know, keeps stopping her and telling her to do different things.
Yeah, yeah.
There was some good stuff in that film.
Like Dustin Hoffman and Hook. That came out around the same time, I think.
Yes, I could hardly see the need for it, but typical of the bizarre twists that were coming out of Hollywood, the teenage Sherlock Holmes and all the rest of that stuff. You know, you can't have teenage Sherlock Holmes and teenage Watson. If you know anything about Sherlock Holmes, they didn't meet until they were adults.
Right.
So it's like, what are you doing? This isn't fun. This isn't the... you're not extending the story. You're contradicting the story and making it pretty stupid, too, because you're introducing the supernatural, and everything in Sherlock Holmes that seems supernatural is actually done by fiendish scientific brilliance or something like that.
Yeah, that's furtherly deducted along the
way. Yes, that gets figured out. And one of them, there's a baboon running around, and another one, they lower a deadly snake on the guy at night when he's sleeping in bed, and no one knows how he gets, you know, but it's all humans doing it. And I'd have gotten away with it, too, if it wasn't for those darn kids, or in this case, for Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John Watson, M.D., who writes the accounts of his friend Sherlock, and who limps somewhat from the Jezail bullet in his leg that he got in Afghanistan. Not some teenager and... Oh, well.
Well, it's like Muppet Babies or Animaniacs or something. Let's just make baby versions of these things.
Terrible of the Warner Brothers cartoon characters. Making them babies is a way to take all the energy and vitality out of them. And besides, Clampett already did it in his cartoon, The Old Gray Hare, where both Elmer Fudd and Bugs Bunny are babies, and then later they're extremely old.
Right.
And Bugs is burying Elmer alive. And I don't know if you remember the cartoon, but it's
being like the gray hair on the face. And,
yes, yeah. Right. And the quivering bent back and quivering voice. Not so funny when you actually get there. Hey, how come they're laughing? This is a serious problem.
My hunch and whatnot.
Yes, at any rate, I hope you've got my back.
Rock, 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 rock.
Going for liquid refreshment? I left my wallet at home. But maybe I won't need it at the tattoo parlor. So K-Rob goes out into the night for some fellowship and delectable alcohol. Except there seems to be a problem with the doorknob. Oh, I was worried we would be sealed in here, imprisoned with the pharaohs in the unescapable tomb where tons and tons of stone had slid down on rivers of sand to lock in place. Impossible to move now that they were where they were supposed to be. With all the priests and all the people who designed it sealed inside, so nobody could get wise. And even if they had been, there was no way to get in there. Until the 20th century, with its power drills and lasers and x-rays and things, got on the case. The land of the pharaohs. Yes. Well, I was going to talk about the Old West, and maybe while K-Rob is off at the nearby watering hole, putting his boot up on the rail and ordering a friendly glass of beer, I can talk about some of the strange characters who used to live in Arizona, itself a strange land, which at one time had a serious problem with the attacking Apaches. They were absolutely remarkable and tough and able to live on nothing in a guerrilla force, which could not be opposed. Now, if you want to think of the most devilish, the meanest, and you could rank them that way, of the Native American warriors, you'd have to say the Comanche beats everybody. But the Apaches were a great regional terror back in Arizona in those days.
To send in
that
money.
You're guaranteed. It's an exception that proves the
mind. Oh, excuse me. Our minds, our hearts,
and our sacred honor.
And our sacred honor are all free.
Our sacred honor or office. $29.95. Look, yes, this special offer is further on.
Not to be repeated. Now you get to our non-sacred honor, and that's a little more pricey.
My sake's alive.
I'll take a tour, a sacred threer.
Right.
No, you take the tour. The sacred tour.
It's for our sacred family.
Yes. Whatever you
Familia
want.
Familia Sagrada.
We will give away. Oh, or we can...
We are sacredness in our sacred time. Here is our official church...
That's right. We're giving away nothing on the show.
Wait, you missed nothing. It's supposed to say
nothing. Well, a lot of people make that
nothing
mistake.
At all.
Mistake about it. About sacredness.
This, Gary, just
it is full scale war. I am against the president.
Oh, really?
Make no mistake
still
about that.
What about, horror monster movies of film?
Let's not wallow in Watergate.
It's calling itself that, but there's no more Warren publications and Forrest Ackerman is dead. But there had many revivals.
I went to the Ackerman Mansion.
Had a strange history.
My girlfriend took me. That was a wonderful thing.
Over it for a time
and created their version of the magazine.
Also, the same people are reading Castle of Frankenstein.
That's the important thing.
Those two, I am content.
Castle of Frankenstein is great.
Now, what about that
issue 41? Just out
can't be beat. That's the greatest issue of Castle of Frankenstein ever.
Valencia and Mission.
Was that it?
It was the San Francisco comic book.
Oh, that's right.
It was run by Gary Arlington.
That's right. That was also a great place, but I'm thinking of another one.
It's gone.
That I think was on Guerrero and maybe 17th. Just a little one. It's a small. I used to visit it every now and then.
Well, there's one over on Valencia.
Was it Valencia?
That sells the underground comics of the new generation.
Yeah.
Zine.
I'm associated with.
They're called zine.
The whole store is full of them.
Nice.
Zine well, after
it's
zine.
For a while. Perhaps
it's the zine scene.
I remember visiting it 10, 15 years ago.
It's there, and Ed Holmes and I should get on the ball and place a bunch of
Dragons. Oh, yeah?
But I was going to talk about the Apache Kid.
Well, they sold them. Oh, yeah.
Not many people know about him.
$5 or something like that. Maybe two and a half, I forget.
Yeah. Give them away, but then nobody would want them, so you have to charge for them.
Check, and they sold them all.
Nice. Well, that's good. At least there's honest business people, and pay their taxes.
If they wanted to make money, they wouldn't be running a comic book store.
Yes, they're in it for the love and the lore of the comic book store.
And there are a lot of interesting artists who hang around there.
Yeah.
That you've never met until you go in there.
Who was not Stan Lee, as I thought, but Stan of Stan's magazine store.
Well, you didn't mean Stan Lowe,
I understand your question. I'm getting tired.
Or Stan Breakage.
I wish you would just think things over for once before you call us up here on the show.
Well, the Apache Kid. He was down by the Gila River, which at that time, with the 1880s, actually flowed. You could have a steamboat on the Gila River, now known as a dry water course. That was the deal then. During the heavy Indian warfare years, or we can call them Native American direct actions, Al Sieber, who was the chief Arizona scout, adopted the son of Apache chief Togo Docus, or Docus, depending on how you pronounce it. And the boy was called the Apache Kid. He was sent to school, and later he was made into a scout, eventually promoting him to first sergeant. But the trouble all started for the Apache Kid when the old Rip killed his father during an Indian dance, an especially bad time to kill one's father. According to the Apache Code of Honor, you see, it was up to the Apache Kid to revenge his father's death by, as one would think, killing his murderer. Al Sieber warned him not to harm old Rip, and the kid listened, but said nothing. Al Al Siebert, and the agent at the San Carlos reservation, whose name was Captain Pierce, headed up to Fort Apache, leaving the kid in charge of the scouts at the agency. As soon as they left, the Apache kid took five of his men and went up to the camp of Old Rip and shot him dead. After the killing, they headed for the kid's tribe. When Sieber returned, he ordered the Apache kid to come into the agency. The Apache kid showed up with 11 of his warriors. Sieber drew a line in front of his tent and then told the Apache kid to take the guns and cartridge belts from the five who had government rifles. He ordered Kid Apache to take his belt and lay it on the ground with his rifle. Again, the Apache kid complied. Next, he ordered the six men to go to the guardhouse. At this point, some of the Indians resisted, and Sieber, setting his rifle, shot one of them. And then all hell broke loose, and in the ensuing gunfight, the Indians wounded Sieber in his weak leg and escaped. The Apaches, led by the Apache kid, went on the warpath and committed several murders before the army troops were able to run them down and capture the Apache kid. In 1899, in Globe, Arizona, during the fall term of the U.S. District Court, the Apache Kid was convicted of desertion and sentenced to a long term in prison. However, after serving for a short time, President Grover Cleveland pardoned him. Immediately after his release, he was arrested again by the civil authorities of Gila County and charged with murder. In July 1890, the Apache Kid and five of his companions received a sentence of life imprisonment at Yuma Territorial Prison. A small posse, made up of Sheriff Glenn Reynolds, Special Deputy William Holmes, the driver Eugene Middleton, and a member of a Tonto Basin family who was having trouble with the Apaches, was transporting 35 Indians and one Mexican prisoner in a special stage. The route took them over the Pinal Mountains on the way to the Yuma Penitentiary. On the second day of the journey on the Gila River near the town of Kelvin, the sheriff took six of the shackled prisoners from the stage, which was at the bottom of a steep sand wash. As the party trudged up the hill, two of the Indians suddenly grabbed the sheriff and two others reeled around on Holmes. Holmes fell backward as his pistol was wrenched from his hand. They shot Sheriff Reynolds and then turned and shot Holmes through the heart. Middleton was in the stage at the bottom of the wash, guarding the remaining two prisoners. One of them was the Apache kid, and he shouted, "I will sit down. Don't shoot." Stage position made it impossible to see what was going on with the others up the bank, and Middleton assumed the shots came from the sheriff. Moments later, the Mexican, seeking shelter, ran up just as one of the escaped Indians, using the sheriff's rifle, fired from behind the coach at Middleton. The four horses bolted. Middleton fell to the ground, shot through the cheek, neck, and left side of his body. The Indians rolled him over, searching for valuables. He felt the cold muzzle of a rifle against his temple. When he heard the Apache kid say, "Save the cartridges, he's dead anyhow." The Mexican prisoner escaped and made his way back to Florence to report the incident, and for this, the governor later pardoned him. Leaving Middleton still playing possum, which he could certainly do with his head a bloody mess, the Indians unshackled themselves, took the commitment papers from the dead sheriff's pocket, tore them up, and left the scene. Middleton waited until he felt it was safe to move. Horribly wounded, he staggered to his feet. Looking at Holmes's body, he saw it was untouched, but the gun muzzle had cut his face and his forehead had been smashed with a rock. It took Middleton the rest of that day and the night to travel the 5 miles back to the Riverside station. A posse from Globe started on the trail of the fugitives but had to return when a snowstorm hit. The renegade Indians had gone up the river to the mouth of the San Pedro, near the site of the town of Hayden, and then on to the San Carlos Reservation. Indian scouts at San Carlos killed most of the outlaw Indians. They tried, convicted, and sentenced to life imprisonment at Yuma one of the outlaw Indians who was wounded in the escape attempt. The Apache Kid escaped and took out his revenge from the Tonto Basin to the Sierra Madre Mountains of Mexico. There were a number of murders in the area, and everyone suspected the Apache Kid had committed them all. Of course, if anyone got murdered, it was convenient to lay it at the feet of the Kid. And there was no evidence that he had anything to do with many of them, according to the chronicles. He returned to the San Carlos Reservation several times. A few times he stole squaws, as it says offensively in the chronicles. But fear kept the Indians from reporting his visits until after he left. From time to time, the Apache Kid would gather small bands of outlaw Apaches and attack his targets in force. One such occasion, on December 12, 1890, renegade Indians surrounded Gun Hinky, Jack Bridger, and Bach Robinson on a hillside 20 miles southeast of the San Bernardino Ranch. Hinky was there to see a steer believed killed by a band of Indians led by the Apache Kid himself. When the three arrived at the steer's location, one of the cowboys swiftly raised his rifle and shot an Indian who happened to be on his way back for more beef. That was when the men realized that they stumbled onto a band of 12 Indians. One of them was a famous warrior known as Bigfoot. And they didn't call him that for nothing, folks. They say his moccasin track shoe was 14 inches long. Anyway, the cowboys took refuge behind the rocks. They were beginning to feel secure when a shot knocked a corncob pipe from Hinky's mouth. Bridger thought that was the funniest thing that he had ever seen, and laughing, he leaned forward and took a bullet right in the head. A few minutes later, another shot came that killed Robinson. Hinky took off, running, outracing an Apache. He struck the trail for camp along the bottom of a sandy gorge with some flowing water. Jumping behind a boulder on the side of the canyon, he took off at a right angle. The Indians kept running down the canyon on the well-trodden trail. Hinky cut off from his horse, headed for the Milt Hall Ranch on foot, 14 miles away. You know, there's a dry wash, at least it's been dry when I've been in it, on the, on the northwest side of the land, on the other side of the Tucson Mountains. And there, I discovered there was a place where there were some big rocks, and there was a place just large enough for a human to get in and lie so that he looks down the trail, so that he looks down the wash and can see everybody who's coming and is absolutely invisible to them, even when they come and pass. A most interesting and useful vantage point. Now, I couldn't say exactly where it was, but I might be able to find it again if I was out there. When men arrived at the massacre, or Native American direct action, the next day, they found the bodies had not been mutilated, as was the usual custom, but the heads had been crushed by rocks. There was no sign of the Indians and no sign of the Apache Kid. In 1899, Colonel Kosterlitsky, a Mexican official, declared that the Apache Kid was still alive and was the head of a little settlement of well-behaved Apaches living in the Sierra Madre Mountains. It's in Mexico. The man tied mostly to the Apache Kid was Al Sieber, Chief Army Scout. While the Apache Kid is known for having been an Army Scout turned bad, Sieber is reputed to have been the best scout the Army ever had. His exploits are legendary. Was in a lonesome valley in the Sierra Madres Mountains, far from the U.S. border, that Sieber, along with his Apache scouts, a small band of soldiers, and General George Crook, were having one of their most important and dangerous meetings. They were in this isolated valley to meet with Geronimo. Sieber found his party surrounded and outnumbered by hostile Apaches. He turned to Scout Tom Horn. Selecting him as the interpreter, he pushed him forward with these instructions. Take a knife, Tom. Stand while you interpret. Forget that you may not live another minute and think only of the talk. The Apaches had agreed to this conference, but no one in the Army group knew if it was to talk terms, to surrender, to stall, or to kill the Army representatives. Sieber took no chances and kept his hand in his shirt on his revolver. He intended to blow Geronimo's brains out at the first hostile move. He honed his nerves of steel during the 21 years he served as an Indian scout for the Army under Generals Stoneman, Miles, Kratz, Wilcox, Gerson, and Crook. If ever there was a man who knew no fear, it was Al Sieber. He was an imposing man, 6'1" and 190 pounds of muscle and confidence. He earned that confidence at Gettysburg, where he fought on the Union side. He also earned a severe gunshot wound that left him with a weak leg and a limp. You know, I think he was killed in some kind of landslide where half of his body, the lower half, was crushed. But even if it wasn't the upper half, he couldn't survive that. But he was notoriously tough. But maybe I'm thinking of somebody else. Sieber arrived in Arizona's Williamson Valley in 1869 to take up farming. That was the year the Golden Spike was driven at Promontory Point in Utah to link the Transcontinental Railroad. For the first time, you could take a train from all the way out there to all the way over here, to Sacramento, as a matter of fact. But the Williamson Valley in Arizona was far from Promontory Point, Utah. I just thought that 69 was a significant year, as was 1969 for me. Well, in the Williamson Valley, there were the usual problems with the Apaches, whom the soldiers seemed unable to control. The citizens of Williamson Valley decided to fight back. They organized and appointed Sieber as their leader. Sieber was able to recover some of the stolen stock and in the process managed to kill many of the hostiles. The Army noticed his success and offered him a position as an Army scout. Initially, he served as a scout operating out of Camp Huachuca, the site of today's Fort Huachuca. His acquaintance with the Apache ways made him an especially valuable man in leading the scouts. Throughout his scouting career, Sieber was in constant danger and bore 29 wounds from Indian fights. Many of the Indians held personal grudges against him, yet he went about his work as though everyone in the entire world was his friend. Say more about Al Sieber. There's a lot. And I may have been wrong about the circumstances of his death. Perhaps that was somebody else in the days of mining. There were so many mines. Everybody was mining, especially after the discovery of gold in 49 or 48. Oh, yeah, I was Sieber. He, after he ended scouting for the government and chasing the Apache Kid everywhere, he went to the Roosevelt Dam building site, and he was the foreman of a large gang of workers who were constructing the dam. And this gang was comprised of Apache Indians. And Zebra got stuck under a rock, and he saw it move. He yelled for the Indian worker to get out of the way, but the boulder toppled on him. Yes, it crushed him from his stomach down, and he never regained consciousness. And they buried Al Sieber, chief of scouts, in the Globe Cemetery. They marked his grave with a monument created by the territory of Arizona. Mystic land. And it was from a cave in Arizona that Captain John Carter, late of the CSA, teleported himself to the planet Mars and eventually became the warlord of Mars. And years later, he returned to the same cave, re-inhabited his body. It was awkward. An awkward moment. Yep, he didn't want to leave Mars. He'd married the beautiful Princess Deja Thoris, and she had laid an egg, as Martian women do, which would have contained his son, Carthoris. But they had problems at the Martian atmosphere plant, which manufactured all the air that Martians breathed in those days. Was it perhaps that a maniac had gotten in and killed the chief technician at the atmosphere plant? And nobody knew how to get in. It was operated by telepathic impulses. But since there's a lot of mind reading going on in the Mars saga, Carter could read the atmosphere plant's mind, and he knew the combination, the eight Martian symbols, which, when thought of in sequence, caused the huge doors to open. So he got in a flyer, that is to say a Martian vehicle, and zoomed down to the atmosphere plant. But already there was not very much air, and people were dying everywhere. And he got there where they were trying to get into the giant building, but of course it had been built so no one could get into it. And he gave the signal, and the doors opened, and there was a guy crawling in to try to start the atmosphere thing. But wouldn't you know it, next he wakes up in an Arizona cave with a skeleton of a hideous old Apache Bruja in there, and all sorts of strange ceremonial fetishistic objects. What that has to do with flying to Mars and astral projection, no one knows.
Look, you're probably the kind of person who's permanently depressed, right?
Yeah, look, this one here.
Gory accident shot.
Well, I've been postulating all night. And
who snapped these pics?
I bet you really don't. Well, he... Look, you've probably been perfectly satisfied so far with what we've been dishing your way. You may be searching for something.
Your body's come alive.
You may feel more like something searching for you.
Terrifying.
Yes. Maybe you just don't care.
Back to sleep.
Why look at the makeup job on that?
You might be fine.
Or you just might be so messed up that you don't even know who Bob is.
Yes,
you have to call this radio show and ask.
I admit you have the superficial.
Of course, there's some considerable weight.
Saturday morning, and then big yawn.
It's so much easier to just let that weight of this show keep you slowed down.
Yeah, I remember
big yawn.
I remember Mama, Life with Father, taking every Sunday.
Doing what you're told.
Scientists are still not sure.
Follow your orders. It's only a message from home sweet home, from everybody down on the farm. Father and mother, sister and brother, praying to protect me from harm. And baby is lisping a simple prayer to guide me where'er I roam. We'll welcome you, Jack, if you ever come back, ran the message from home sweet home. Oh, it's only a message from home sweet home, from everybody down on the farm. Boom, 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 boom. Father and mother, sister and brother, praying to protect me from harm. And
Isabel met a troublesome giant. Isabel continued self-reliant. The giant was hairy. The giant was horrid. He had one eye in the middle of his forehead.
He was a son of Neptune, one of the Cyclopes, a race of giants which built enormous structures.
So what's your real reason, Bob?
And only Cyclops or Cyclopes could have built them. And their Cyclopean architecture.
Trying to get a hold of someone in Newcastle.
Newcastle?
Bob every day.
That's why you sound under the influence of certain drugs.
We've been carrying tolls to there for years.
Sir, do you mean Bob Nelson, or do you mean Bob Dobbs?
For being specific.
Bob Dobbs.
No, you don't. You mean Bob Dubs.
No.
Yes, and Bib Dibs.
No.
Does Bob got a brother?
Bob dissipates into
Ted Dobbs.
Yes.
Well, actually, he's got a bunch of brothers, but
no, now you did it. Now you did it.
Brothers aren't worth anything. They're not worth a.
Unfortunately, I mean, I don't know how to tell you this, but Bob's dead.
Well, I heard that a couple weeks ago.
They blew that sucker away. They took him down and they blew him away. Took him
I see Bob all the time.
In the
department store, these mannequins.
Which one?
Man or mannequin? Man, oh my God!
Oh, yeah, you're right. I guess
whole
body stuffed.
He's got a fishing rod and his reel.
And they've got him in a lucite block up on top of a skyscraper in Dallas.
Right.
All right. Now that's a little bit too much information.
He could escape if he managed to melt it somehow. We don't know what his powers are.
Diamond Island, starring
three
families
just died.
Not Double Trouble on Diamond Island again.
See, this is our win.
The horrible, rotten smell of burning flesh. Okay, well, what happened to
enough time for rotting to take place?
Now I'm confused here.
Don't investigate those utility holes too completely, or those utility
holes. Rats as big as schnauzers in there, and spiders as big as poodles.
And try to avoid those creatures.
Yeah, and you wouldn't want to mess with them things.
Well, the Lord must have made them too.
Don't get any on you. No, what's the purpose of trying to warn people? They'll just have to find out for themselves.
Bibbidi bobbidi boom.
We're not able
to shot Tycho.
Just
yeah, I know.
When this took place. You have to
you
be
for Daniel Besky Redskin.
He
has been killed.
Why do you carry on this?
Thanks for listening to our story.
It's only your conspiracy
because we make so much money
to make these assumptions about us.
Yes,
they're even trying to get us into this. And mark our words, if they succeed,
have fun.
If Bob ever becomes popular in the wrong way with the people that listen to this show, if he ever becomes as wholesome as he looks, then on that day, an imitation church of the subjects will
like
place the original
bread.
And the elder gods will be one last step from doing something so unthinkable that we don't even want to think about it. He'll be sowing your church air and you'll pay your soul to get one last lungful. And then you'll paint it on and you won't be able to.
cold flu.
What's going on, eh?
Yeah. Doctor, doctor, yeah, please calm yourself. Here, have an injection.
You can see it. You can see it.
Hello.
Doctor, I have a learned colleague has become over.
Hello.
We didn't come to borrow any money. We didn't come to borrow any dough. We didn't come to borrow any trouble. We just dropped in to say hello.
Hello. See is the real pulse pounding real.
Hello. Well, that ended that stream.
Did you get a nice beverage over there?
I got one, I bought another, and it's sitting on the little stoop that's like, it's kind of like my own little bar right there by the door.
And nobody will mess with it or molest it while you're not.
Well, I mean,
you could drink it right in, bring it right in here.
Well, I don't want to take it past the centuries.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
They wouldn't care for that.
They wouldn't like the flagrant optic of it all.
Yes.
You know, like they honestly, personally wouldn't mind if I just brought a pint into this building. But, like, there's all these people that are watching them do their job. And if they see me do something that's, like, that's something that nobody else should be able to do, it looks kind of bad, you see. It's a bad look.
It looks like they're not doing their job.
Yeah. And, like, their whole thing is their job. And you gotta be doing it to do it.
Right. They're not out there for fun, sitting out in front of the club for hours on end.
Yeah. But they are having fun.
Well, of course. Yeah. There's always some fun to be
had. But the job comes first, you see.
True.
And there are a couple of nice folks.
I found them so.
Yeah. The score. I think Radio Valencia is lucky to have them. Be the people that are right outside the door.
Well, that's good. You know, we want a certain amount of attention, but not too much.
Yes.
You'll observe that I used twisty ties to fasten the curtains together so they couldn't come peeping and looking and coveting our equipment and maybe building a scaffold.
Look at those people inside of that room.
Say, I bet you could sell those microphones and get some fentanyl or something.
Yeah. People are looking at this station with fentanyl eyes.
And getting ready to do the dance craze that's sweeping the nation, the fentanyl fold.
All you need is a scaffold to do the fentanyl fold. Steal some microphones from a radio station and you'll get your fentanyl. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm still working on it.
Very, really as good as money. We pull one.
Come on, guys. It's beyond obvious. Relodio stole the Radio Valencia microphones for fentanyl. Sit
down and there had to be a motive.
You think Relodio just smokes itself? Well, how do you actually take fentanyl? Is it a smoke or a snort or what?
I think he smokes it in a little pipe.
Okay. So it's just like a smoking of the crack.
Yes, they're hanging men and women for the smoking of the crack.
Smoking of the crack. Smoking of the crack.
Right here.
We all live in the pipe.
Raring to go. That they smoke. Smoke on Bart. Smoke on the bus. Smoke when you're trying to walk down the street or to get through the door of the store.
C-3PO on Chewbacca's back, and the Empire strikes back.
Smoking crack. Yes, the Empire did have a drug problem.
Yeah, he had a robot on his back. The Wookiee back.
That's right. Well, there's this new Predator movie.
Get my Wookiee back, get my one. Sorry.
You know about this Predator movie that's out now?
questions, I give the answers.
Well, that's what I was kind of referring to, because there's a scene where...
He's got a female robot piece attached to his back.
Exactly. And it's just like C-3PO and Chewbacca.
But I thought she was more like a comely babe, or like the top half of her.
Yeah, but she's a chatty babe, you see. Like, C-3PO is a chatty robot.
Now I get it. Yeah, he chats, and we can't understand what R2 is saying. A bewildering series of beeps and boops.
Right, but C-3PO makes up for both of their dialogue with his excessive dialogue. And Elle Fanning makes use of that trope in Predator Badlands.
We suggest.
And Elle Fanning not only plays the good robot, but also the evil twin robot.
Wow, that's quite a heap of robots there.
But perhaps we can be cured.
And I dare say it's kind of like in Star Trek The Next Generation, there was Data, and there was also Lore, which was the evil Data.
Yes, was he a defective android who had been built by the creator of those two?
Well, the creator created both of them.
And he was Dr. Sue or something like that?
Yeah.
Also played by Brent Spiner.
I have, as the moderator...
So the Elle Fanning robot character has, like, the Data slash Lore tension.
Hey, Windy caller, be afraid. It's cold, I know, but go ahead and talk.
But there's also, like, oh, it's like she's like C-3PO, too, and Chewbacca's back, because the Predator is Chewbacca, and she's C-3PO.